In this show, we get a masterclass in self-awareness from Ian Morgan Cron, a New York Times bestseller, an expert in the Enneagram system, which helps individuals to understand their preferences more clearly in relationships. As an experienced psychotherapist, he brings wisdom and a much-needed soulfulness to our conversation about how leaders build radical self-awareness, enabling them to break out of unhelpful, reactive cycles.
Hello and welcome to The Evolving Leader. Scott Allender here, along with my dear friend and colleague, a man who ages like a fine box of wine, Mr. John Gomes.
Well, there's no such thing as a fine box of wine in the UK. I don't know what you have out there, but they're all in bottles, the fine ones.
Well, I'm just going to leave that there for now. How are you feeling today, my friend?
I am feeling excited because I haven't met our guest, but I've heard wonderful things about him. Really, really curious. And, you know, I love the topic, so I'm excited. How are you feeling, Scott?
Well, I am super excited. I'm elated because today, as you mentioned on the show, we have a good friend of mine, New York Times bestselling author and host of the wildly popular podcast Typology, Ian Morgan Cron. Now, John, you know this because I bend your ear about it every chance I get, but our listeners probably don't know. Of all the personality and psychometric systems that I work with, there's nothing I have found to be more personally impactful or as transformative as the Enneagram. And our guest today is probably the reason that I fell in love with the Enneagram system in the first place and decided to get professionally certified. For anyone who may not know what I'm talking about, the Enneagram is an ancient personality typing system that identifies 9 primary types of people and how they relate to one another and the world. Ian is a champion and master teacher of the Enneagram, a psychotherapist, and best-selling author of the popular Enneagram book, The Road Back to You. And as a pioneer in the contemporary Enneagram movement, Ian is a highly sought-after speaker for large conferences and corporate boardrooms alike. For anyone unfamiliar with the Enneagram, that's okay. Don't tune out because you don't have to know anything about the Enneagram to get a tremendous amount of value out of today's conversation. Trust me, if you're at all interested in cultivating a more radical self-awareness, you're going to want to keep listening. So, Ian, welcome to The Evolving Leader.
Well, thank you, Scott and John. I'm glad to be here.
So, Ian, this podcast is not obviously an Enneagram podcast. In fact, I don't think I've specifically mentioned the Enneagram on The Evolving Leader before, though in season one, we did do a 2-part series on 9 types of fear, which was largely informed by the Enneagram. But this is a show about helping leaders to cultivate radical self-awareness and exploring ways for us all to do that more intentionally and invest in our capacity to confront some of the biggest challenges facing our world today. So with that in mind, we've been talking to several different guests from all different kinds of disciplines, from neuroscientists to Olympic athletes, CEOs, coaches, creatives, psychologists, people in tech, and we even spoke to an astronaut recently. So we are truly trying to advance the leadership conversation in a new and more multidisciplinary way, and that's why we're so excited to have you here. So, Ian, can you start by sharing with us a bit about what the Enneagram is, how you came to know about it, write about it, teach it, eat it, sleep it, all of that?
Sure. The Enneagram, as you mentioned, is a personality typing system that teaches that there are 9 basic personality styles in the world, one of which we gravitate toward and adopt in childhood as a way to cope, to protect ourselves, and to navigate the world of relationships. Very importantly, each type has a unconscious motivation that powerfully influences how that type acts, thinks, and feels on a predictable and habitual basis.
So, Ian, I understand you normally take a full day to teach the entire system. We can't do that now, but just for greater clarity, can you just quickly run us through those 9 core personality types for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. And what I'll do is I will articulate the unconscious motivation that is the driver of their actions, thoughts, and feelings in the world. The first is called the improver. And the improver type 1 is motivated by a need to perfect themselves, others, and the world. Twos are called the helpers, sometimes the befrienders. These are people who are motivated by a need to meet the needs of other people. Threes are called the performers, and they are motivated by a need to succeed, to appear successful, and to avoid failure at all costs. Fours are called the individualists. They are motivated by a need to be special and unique in order to compensate for what they perceive is a fatal flaw or missing piece in their essential makeup. Fives are called the investigators, sometimes the observers. They are motivated by a need to gather lots of knowledge and information, to conserve energy, all in a bid to fend off what they perceive is an intrusive, draining, and demanding world that drains them, that depletes them. Sixes are called the loyalists. Their unconscious motivation is a need to feel safe and secure and supported in a threatening world. Sevens are called the enthusiasts. They're the joy bombs of the Enneagram. They are people who have a need to avoid emotional and psychological distressing thoughts and feelings. Eights are called the challengers. They have a need to assert strength and control over the environment and others in order to mask vulnerability and weakness. And finally, the nines are called the peacemakers. They're sometimes called the sweethearts of the Enneagram. They have a need to maintain a sense of internal and external peace, right? They are the type on the Enneagram that wants to maintain inner Hakuna Matata at all times, okay? And they are always conflict averse. They want to avoid conflict at all costs.
So inherent in what you've just said there, I think, is a topic that we're really fascinated here, which is the hidden self, you know, hidden from ourselves. And Scott and I have been looking at this rather extensive research that shows that the more self-aware somebody thinks they are, the less self-aware they typically are. That presents quite a significant challenge in this. Why do you think that is? And how does this hidden self stand in the way of that, do you think?
Well, you know, human beings don't come equipped with a hatch. They can simply open up and look into their internal world and see all of the forces that are governing their lives under the waterline of consciousness, right? We're not fishbowls, right? We can't look down into ourselves and clearly see, look, there goes my mommy issues. You know, it's not like you can look inside. We are the greatest mystery to ourselves that we have to face every single day, right? Oftentimes, it's other people who see us more clearly than we do ourselves. The sense of self is developed in a social context. And then finally, I would say, one of the things the Enneagram does is reveal to us not only our strengths. I mean, let's face it, who doesn't want to take an inventory called Strengths Finder? I mean, I'd do that all day long. Stroke my ego. As a friend of mine, though, likes to say, if what you're looking for is flattery, don't play around with the Enneagram. It's also going to reveal to you the shadow aspects of your personality style. And the unconscious has this little trick. Whenever it begins to come in contact with or shine a torch on its own failures, its own defects, if you will, it immediately wants to take that torch and put it somewhere else, you know, on something else. So what the Enneagram does is it doesn't let you do that. It, with uncanny accuracy, it reveals those behaviors, ways of thinking and feeling that are self-defeating and self-sabotaging in our relationships, in our work, in our leadership, and at home, and in our friendships, our social context outside of the workplace. So it is a powerful tool in that regard.
So one of the things that you mentioned, I've heard you say this a few times, is that the Enneagram system doesn't put you in a box. It reveals to you the box that you're already in and gives you a map on how to get out of it, which is one of the reasons I fell in love with it and have gotten so much value in my own life and in the work that I do with teams. But in a business context, it can be a little complex because the system is complex. And so sometimes leaders might gravitate towards things like a Strength Finder or Myers-Briggs, which have their own value. But you've managed to find a way to bring this complex system into corporate settings with incredible success. How have you done that? What's your approach to bringing the system to leaders and teams and helping them do this difficult work of becoming more self-aware?
Well, you know, in a perfect world, you can do an 8-hour workshop. And Scott, you know, I've done that at Warner Brothers. I've done that at Discovery Channel. I've just done it in lots and lots of corporations. Mm-hmm. However, I've done many 4-hour workshops. In fact, John, I have one coming up with a firm in London for 2 4-hour days with their leadership team. You know, I've been able to customize and adapt the work to different companies with different needs, whether it's a leadership team or it's an internal team that or division that's having struggles or wants to help their leaders grow in self-awareness. So, you know, it is possible to teach the Enneagram in short chunks of time. It's not easy, right? I mean, you get what you pay for. If you get 8 hours, you're going to learn a lot more than you're going to learn in a 4-hour session. That said, part of the genius of the Enneagram is, and this is where I struggle a little bit with Myers-Briggs, and I know you're certified in that as well, Scott, is it's complicated, right? I mean, it's, you know, I studied it in graduate school, and I'm an ENFP. I still don't know what that means. You know what I'm saying? Like, it has its own lexicon.
I do. That's all you need to know. I know what you're like now.
But it has its own lexicon, and you really have to be trained in it to understand its value, but with the Enneagram, you know, it's pretty accessible pretty fast, and it's actionable pretty fast. And it's easy to learn the Enneagram, but it's hard to master it. However, if you just get the basics, that alone is helpful and immediately actionable. So that's the way I try to present it to people. And of course, I've been given as little as an hour and a half with a team to introduce it. And it'll be helpful, even in 90 minutes. It would be obviously more helpful in 8 hours. But I've seen good results across the board.
If we just go a little layer deeper, you're not just one type. You're composed of different elements of these types as well. Can you just take us a little bit in terms of, you know, what does that look like? What are the relationships between the different types as well for an individual?
Well, that's a great point, John. You know, I'm oftentimes having to tell people, you are all 9 types, right? You contain all 9 types. It's simply that you gravitate toward one more than all the others. So, I mean, in the course of I'm a 4 on the Enneagram, and that probably explains to Scott why I'm an ENFP on the mic. But I certainly have features of the 1 in my life, right? The perfectionist. When it comes to writing, I'm too much of a perfectionist, right? I have a, you know, kind of a geek out knowledge side like the 5 has, you know, or I have some of the worst case scenario thinking of the 6. However, they are not the default unconscious motivation that drives the way that I act, think, and feel on a regular basis. So it's important for people that they don't look at simply traits and characteristics in order to determine their type. If they do, they will identify with every single type. The key is for people to look at the different unconscious motivations and try to identify which of those 9 unconscious motivations sounds and feels most like them. Once you figure that out, then you either determine your type or you know you're in the neighborhood of your type. And then you can refine it from there. There are other also tools to help people clarify type. The other thing, can I say this, John, because I think it's important to your point. People often say to me or look at me incredulously and they say, 9 types, 7 billion people on the planet? That seems a little reductive. And what I have to remind them of is that there are an infinite variety of shades and hues and contrasts found in each of those 9 types. In fact, you will often find 2 people who are of the same type who look completely different. Now, we don't have time today to go into subtypes. That's where you'll begin to learn how to delineate some of those hues and contrasts. But it's important for people to realize that they are their own expression of that type. No one inside a type looks identical to another person inside that type, which I also love about the Enneagram. It allows for this multiplicity, this endless multiplicity of expressions of each of the types.
So let's bring this into a leadership context if we can. So I'd be curious to know from your vantage point what you think some of the biggest leadership challenges that are facing the world today, and how could a leader getting in contact with that unconscious motivation help them to rise to those challenges and become a more effective, impactful leader?
All right. It's a great question. Well, one thing I would say is that in times of crisis, I think that leaders tend to give up being leaders and become micromanagers. Mm. They move from staying at 100,000 feet, and then they start diving into the weeds, and it's purely driven by anxiety and panic. And then they start to get in the way of their team. What I tell leaders is, whatever you do in crisis, make sure that you stay at 100,000 feet. That's where your people need you. They need you at 100,000 feet. If you start diving down, everybody's going to hunker and get myopic. What you have to do is stay at 100,000 feet. And that's hard. That really requires you burn some calories to stay up there when times are tough. You know, obviously, another thing that I tell people is that leaders are part of the human population, and therefore they struggle with self-awareness. But the stakes are higher. The stakes are higher that a leader develop self-knowledge, that they develop, you know, this ability to observe and regulate, right, the way that they act, think, and feel in the course of a given day. And they have to become other aware. In other words, they need to understand how different members with different personality styles on their teams function in the world. Because here's the deal, and I say this to leaders a lot. One of the most egregious mistakes a leader can make is to presume that their way of seeing the world is normal.
Mm.
I mean, if the Enneagram is right, and I believe that it is, then there are 9 normals. I was just working with a leader the other day, and he has this thing with people where he, this is the absolute truth. He said, well, when I want people to change, I just go, change. And I was like, what? And now, 8, the challenger on the Enneagram. And he just gets in people's grill and he just claps his hands twice and he goes, just change. And I went, who's that working? You can do that with another 8 on the Enneagram, but you can't do that to a 2. You can't do that to a 1. You can't do that to a 5. That is not incentivizing. It's not inspiring, nor does it lead them in the direction of change. If anything, it will help them embed themselves more deeply in their patterns. They'll just start taking a defensive stance. I said, what you have to do is realize that not everybody like you sees the world in such a way that just change works. And here's the other thing. A leader who presumes that their way of seeing the world is normal will automatically deem people who see the world differently than they do as abnormal. And they will feel free to judge then that person's way of seeing the world. So I think this self-awareness and other awareness is something that's a challenge for leaders, not only in our current context, but really in good times and in bad times, right? Yeah. It's a walking through the world with more emotional wisdom. I think that there's a paucity of emotional wisdom among leaders.
We have been talking a lot in the show with guests about the underlying challenge of leaders needing to be able to hold opposites, to be able to not choose between left and right, black and white, today, tomorrow, and so on. And one of the underlying interpretations of the Enneagram to get the most out of it is to see those tensions within yourself. You know, you have a center of gravity around one type, but you're being pulled consciously and unconsciously with the others. What do you think, in terms of building a muscle of consciousness, the Enneagram can help you to do in terms of the capacity to be able to see and hold opposites?
Well, I agree with you 100%. I think that people And this is very frustrating for certain types on the Enneagram who tend to be more black and white, either or, us versus them in their mentality. And they'll have to work a little bit harder at this than, let's say, you know, my type, which is a 4 or a 9. These are people who have an easier time coping with paradox, coping with the fact that human beings are a bundle of contradictions. And I think that one of the things the Enneagram does that I think is also very powerful, and Scott, you'll have to correct me, more powerful than other systems that don't provide a transformational growth path, a set of challenges that they have to face in their own life if they are going to grow in self-awareness. So I would say that for all types, that one important discipline, and I believe every leader should have this discipline, is the practice of mindfulness, a daily practice of mindfulness. Leaders hate it when I say that.
They're like, downtime.
That is so woo-woo is what I hear. You know, you can do that in Silicon Valley, Ian, but you can't do that on Wall Street, right? And I'm like, well, okay. But if you want to develop the attentional muscle, to your point, John, the ability to observe this, to live more consciously in the world, you need to develop a habit that builds the ability to have an inner observer, the ability to step back from yourself in real time, to pause, to observe how you're acting, thinking, and feeling, how the other person is acting, thinking, and feeling, and what to do in that moment to create the smoothest line of communication. You can't do that unless, and research shows this, you can go to Stanford, you can go to the University of Massachusetts Amherst, countless other business schools are teaching mindfulness in many ways for this very reason. Most people live in reactivity all the time. They're just simply reacting. What mindfulness does for you is give you the capacity to pause, to step back, to observe, to do so with compassion and empathy rather than judgment or having an evaluative spirit, and to make different choices than you used to do. Let me put it this way, to respond rather than react in the moment. A good leader, you know, I tell leaders all the time, I said, you know, people who live in reactivity are like people trapped in a phone booth, if I dare say that word in the current context, phone booth with a murder hornet. You know, they're just slapping around and they're like jumping. But a person who responds has this sort of calm groundedness that's able to see what's going on right now. How do I need to be present in this moment, in this relationship, in this problem to reach a wise decision? And, you know, the most efficient way I know how to do that is to begin a mindfulness practice. Long answer to your question, but an important question.
What would be a pragmatic first step to developing a good mindfulness practice, especially for someone who's never done it?
So there is a million books on mindfulness now. If you simply went on Google and you pumped in mindfulness and business, mindfulness and leadership, right? There are a million books and articles on the topic. You could go to the Harvard Business Review and pump in mindfulness. It is such a hot topic in corporate spheres now. Mm-hmm. Lots of companies, granted, lots of them in Silicon Valley, that actually have spaces where people can go for mindfulness practice on premise, on their campuses. So I think, again, what happens in mindfulness also is what begins to bubble up in the practice of meditation are some of the patterns of thinking and feeling that you begin to observe and go, isn't it interesting? Everything I think about is a to-do. Mm. My whole thinking process is a to-do list. It has nothing to do with feelings, right? Mm. Well, that's a big cue that in your mind, it's like, I wonder why that is. Maybe it's because I don't know what to do with feelings, and I better figure out what to do with feelings because people drag a lot of them to work with them. You know what I mean? So again, a lot of these books and resources would begin to help people, you know, figure that out. Maybe we can share with some offline and you can put them in the show notes.
That'd be great.
So in the context of our current situation in the COVID world, with all the restrictions that people are experiencing, and you know, we're hearing repeatedly from our friends, from you know, colleagues and so on, this feeling that we're losing a sense of control over our lives. What's your thoughts on what leaders can do to increase a sense of agency for themselves and for others?
Well, the first thing is to recognize that that control is really an illusion. None of us is actually in control. And if what you're looking for is control, you're going to be barking up the wrong tree. But what we have to do as leaders is realize that we are always being bombarded with situations where our control over the outcomes is limited. So we have to make decisions and live in a world that will perhaps best reach the outcome we think is right, but understanding that it's, you know, our ability to do so has constraints and boundaries. And so being open to other approaches. I mean, one of the beautiful things about the Enneagram is if you get a team that's aware of other people's strengths, right, associated with their style, a leader can really begin to listen. And if they can hold their position very loosely, right, with a light grip, they may find solutions on the team that they hadn't previously thought of, because that type sees the situation completely different than they do. Completely different, probably. And, you know, again, I think one of the things that leaders can do is develop deep listening skills, you know, deep listening skills, and then take the time to assimilate the information, right, and to determine a good course forward. And then on a separate note, John, I would say this. One of the things I'm excited about, and I just happened upon this article the other day in Harvard Business Review that was, again, underscoring the importance of self-awareness. I think in the post-COVID world, we have an opportunity to completely rewrite the script. I mean, that's the beauty of this moment. The temptation for some leaders will be, how do we get back to the way things used to be? And I think that's a catastrophic mistake. It's a missed opportunity. This is an opportunity to ask ourselves, okay, we've got a bit of a clean slate here. I mean, COVID has really wiped out a lot of the ways that we used to do things. A question I've asked leaders before when they come with a problem, I say to them, ask yourself, what does this make possible? It's a very powerful question. They'll come saying, okay, I got this problem. And you know, and they only see it in a negative light. And I want to spin it more positive and go, okay, forget that. Ask yourself, what does this new problem make possible? And think people now have the freedom to rewrite things in a way that they would have gotten so much pushback in the past. Now people are looking for new direction. That's exciting to me. If someone is willing to have the imagination to meet the moment.
So in the current moment, Ian, I know a lot of people are experiencing a variety of difficult emotions, and one of them being increased sense of loneliness this last year from working from home and such. Is there anything that the Enneagram can bring to them in terms of resilience or just a greater capacity to endure this moment?
Well, you are absolutely right. Loneliness in the workplace and actually in the broader context of life has now reached crisis proportions. In fact, and John, you'll have to sort of tell me if this is the case. I'm pretty sure that now the British government has a minister of loneliness. That's extraordinary. The problem has reached such a height that the government of Great Britain is now saying, we actually have to appoint a person to start to reverse the momentum of this problem. Is that right?
Yeah. Theresa May, the former prime minister, appointed Tracy Crouch as the first minister of loneliness because they had done, I think it was the Joe Cox Commission, had done a study on loneliness that said that nearly 10 million people in Britain are always feeling lonely. And that costs the country several billion, I think $3.5 billion pounds a year. So it's a huge problem.
See how important it is for leaders to take this kind of data into consideration? There, if all you're thinking about is the profit of your stakeholders and your shareholders, and you're not paying attention to self-awareness, you're not paying attention to creating a culture in which people can bring their whole self to work and be known and therefore feel less lonely. I mean, I think that leaders are crazy if they're not beginning to pay attention to these topics. You have to see the connection between soft skills and things like compassion, empathy, open culture, making it possible for people to bring their authentic self to work. You better pay attention to this stuff, because ultimately, guess what? It does affect your bottom line. You can't just focus on grit, determination, great strategic planning, charisma, you know, all these different sort of hard skills. You got to pay attention to the soft skills, or you're going to be behind the ball for sure. The Enneagram can help at the very least in helping people feel more known, right? Ray Dalio, you know, the legendary hedge fund manager, money manager, I'm not sure what we would call him. He has a book called Principles. And one of the things that he does is he gives now, because he can, he's developed his own personality assessment. And he makes every new person, new hire, do this, right? So when he has 20 new hires and they have a month worth of orientation, the first thing he does is assign them this personality assessment, because he said, not because I can figure out how to, you know, then slot them or do this or the next thing. It's because I want them immediately to know each other. Mm. I mean, that's extraordinary. I want them to know each other. And that simple step alone would help to decrease the sense of loneliness. I mean, loneliness has a great deal to do with not being seen, not understood, not being known, and therefore not belonging, not feeling like you have genuine belonging, genuine value on a team. So again, I'm very concerned about loneliness in the workplace. And I do think the Enneagram can bring a lot to that conversation among when it's used in tandem, probably with other instruments and tools. Hmm.
Did you know you can find us on Twitter at @evolving_leader? We're also on Instagram and LinkedIn. If you're on any of these social media platforms, we invite you to follow along and comment on your favorite episodes. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
So, Ian, I want to quote you.
Oh, no.
Buried in the deepest precincts of our beings, I sense a truer, more luminous expression of ourselves. And as long as we remain estranged from it, we will never feel fully aware, alive, or awake. So what does it feel to be fully alive and fully awake? What's your take on that?
Okay, let's hit psychotherapy for a minute. Okay, just some psychological truths about human beings, all right, that is borne out in the writing in multiple schools of psychology. All of us have, as little people, begin to receive and internalize messages that come with distorted, errant, even wrong beliefs about who we are and how the world works. And the older you get, the more and more layers of those beliefs come into play, right? Think of each one as a veil that covers the truest expression of who we are, that we were as little people. Part of the journey of every human being, leaders and others, is to go about the business of identifying and removing or challenging some of those uninterrogated assumptions about who we are and how the world works. And again, I think, the Enneagram is a very fast, accessible, and actionable way to do it. And once we do, the more we remove some of these self-limiting beliefs and feelings and thoughts, the closer we get to that truer expression of who we are. So it is, in that sense, a psycho-spiritual journey. And when I say spiritual, I don't mean religious. What I'm talking about is that core of the human person looking for meaning and purpose in the world. Without a sense of meaning and purpose in our work and in the broader world, we lose hope. And when you lose hope, you lose just about everything.
Hmm. So Ian, as the road back to you continues to sell at an extraordinary pace, you've written a new book that I believe is coming out this fall. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, it's a follow-up to The Road Back to You. The title is still in hot debate with my publisher, as titles often are. And what the new book does is take a narrative approach to the Enneagram. Rather than thinking of each of these nine types as simply personality styles, it's interesting when you begin to think of them as stories we tell ourselves and others about who we are and how the world works. I think the reason it's an important contribution to this conversation is because we think of our lives narratively. Each of us thinks about our lives as a story, being storied through us all the time, right? We don't ask people, please tell me facts about your life. Mm. We always say to somebody, hey, tell me your story. And so I also think it's easier when you tell people, all right, it's possible for you to rewrite the story of your life. And when you tell people that, they look at you like, what? I just thought I was stuck in this story. Mm-hmm. And when you tell them, well, you know, as an adult, you have agency. You have the ability to go back into your life and rewrite the story. You can't change the facts of the past, but you can change the way that you interpret them and the way that you live in them. So I'm excited for people to hear that, because I think it's a new way to bring about transformation in the human life. Because as one therapist, Dan McAdams at Northwestern University, likes to say, all transformation is story transformation. Hmm. I mean, that's worth repeating. All transformation is story transformation. And as the author Mo Willems likes to say, if you find yourself in the wrong story, leave. And think about it. Now, Scott, you're a performer on the Enneagram. You're a three on the Enneagram. The underlying premise of your story is I must succeed, appear successful, and avoid failure at all costs if I'm going to experience satisfaction, if I'm going to experience, you know, fulfilling my remit in my work. That's not true. That is a very bad underlying premise for a story.
Right. Right.
And when you begin to identify some of these things and say, you know what, I kind of need to address this, because that helped you as a little person get by in the world. It helped you make sense of the world. But as Carl Jung likes to say, that which helps you in the morning of life will kill you in the afternoon of life. Mm. So we really have to begin to go into our stories and say, is this story really serving me anymore? And I guarantee you will say, a large piece of it isn't, and I need to change it.
Yeah, and I'm really interested how you, I mean, you know, you live and breathe this. How's your awareness of your own story, and how's that? How have you hacked the assumptions around that life that you've built around the story that you've been telling yourself?
Well, part of it is self-reflection, and that's something else leaders need to do. To be able to observe what's driving the way that I act, think, and feel. And by the way, why is it that I see repeating patterns in my past that seem to happen over and over again that are screwing me, right? Why have I been fired three times for the same thing? Like, why is it that though I get up in the morning and promise myself, I will not do this again?
That's why I've been asking Scott all these years.
But then 4 hours out, you know, 4 hours later, we find ourselves doing that very thing again. Well, it's because we're attacking a behavior instead of an unconscious motivation. Hmm. We're just stuck in a story like it's Groundhog Day, right? It's just over and over again, same thing, same results, right? Well, that requires that we really sort of decode the story. And the Enneagram will actually really help with this, because self-reflection is difficult and it can take a long time. I still think it's necessary, but the Enneagram can get you a big leap forward on that journey. It's heart work, by the way. It's not mind work. It's heart work. And for a lot of people, they make the huge error of thinking, as a leader, I don't have time for hard work. I got to get results. And I'm like, you are missing it, man. You don't understand that your way of being in the world that exists at the level of your heart is affecting the way you make decisions, the way that you're resolving conflict, the way that you are creating culture, etc. If you don't do that work, that soft work, you are self-sabotaging. Mm.
So I'm going to push you again. How have you changed your story?
It's an ongoing process. Now, I represent one of the numbers on the Enneagram that tends to show up in particular industries. For example, the creative arts. For me, the Enneagram has given me a lexicon and a vernacular to begin to do that work of deconstruction of my story and then reconstruction of the story. It's actually been very difficult. Some of it is actually painful to face those parts of my story that no longer serve me and that I have found myself stuck in for a long, long time. I won't go into the details of some of that because I'm a 4 on the Enneagram, and you would be on this call for the next 3 hours if I stopped. But you know, let me just give you an example. Let's say you're an 8 challenger on the Enneagram, and someone says to you that the underlying premise of your story has been, I have seen the world as a might makes right world, where I have to live in a defended posture all the time. And I tend to be a driver, not because I'm, you know, the hero of the story, but because I'm trying to mask weakness and vulnerability, you know, and you begin to hear that. It's like, well, there's the underlying premise, and you can flesh that out, you know, in your own story. But when the 8 begins to do that and say, and then ask themselves the question, is that true? Is that premise really true? It's not. It may be partially true, but it's not completely true. And the resulting behavior has really compromised your ability to lead well. How do you rewrite the story? Yes, we live in a world where betrayal is possible, but it's not fatal. And there are lots of relationships in which we can feel safe to reveal our true self. And I'm going to move through the world with a greater degree of trust and vulnerability, because vulnerability is a critical piece of leadership. It's critical. I'm not saying that a leader should go to work and, you know, begin to do therapy with their team, right? And just be gushy vulnerable. That's inappropriate. But if your team doesn't see you being appropriately vulnerable about your fears, your anxieties, your concerns, they won't feel safe to be vulnerable, right? Then you create a toxic workspace in which people feel like, I've got to make sure that I've got to please my 8 leader and not show any vulnerability. And that means you got to leave a big piece of yourself at the door every day. And that's not healthy.
So John quoted you. So now it's my turn. As we wrap up, I want to read an excerpt from something that poetically captures, I think, what it is to do this work. And it's out of your manifesto. So I'm not going to read all of it, but I'm going to read a section of it. You say, today I will throw my hat into the ring of life. I will live a better story. I will live wholeheartedly present and awake in the moment. I will stand on my own 2 feet and live my truth. I will widen my circle of compassion to include more people. I will look into the eyes of the broken and say, me too. You go on to say a few more beautiful words, and you conclude with, today I will be my true self. Man, my friend, there isn't a more evolved leader than someone who can do that.
I agree.
Thank you. Thank you for those words, and thank you for inspiring us today.
My pleasure. It was really fun. Thanks.
Well, I just want to thank you, Ian. I think you've really opened our minds, but also probably more importantly, our hearts too. Thank you.
My pleasure. Glad to spread the word.
Thanks, Ian. Well, my friends, we hope you feel motivated and challenged to pursue a more radical self-awareness after our time with Ian today. And as always, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?